Talk given Saturday, 18th November, 1972. It is customary in the religious sphere to think of the spiritual world as something quite different from the physical material world. The usual conception is that the spiritual world, set in the context of eternity, of absoluteness, of transcendence, is the prototype and the source of the creative power and energy which brings into being the material world to which we mortals belong. Now I want to put it quite the other way around. The whole spiritual world as presented in the scriptures of the world is the product of man's thought and verbal expression. By this I do not mean that this is spun out of the imagination of speculative philosophers. What I mean is this, and let us follow this very carefully. You have often heard me speak in terms of pure mind, which is a transcendent energy, immeasurable, shapeless, formless, indefinable, an energy with which I cannot deal. I cannot dictate to it. I cannot bend it to my will. This is transcendence, the realm of transcendence itself. And there is energy which we know in the usual way. In its secondary stages, in its primordial condition, we don't know it. The world of science doesn't know it. But we know energy in its different forms as electricity, heat, light, chemical energy, and so on. And this energy we can measure, we can control, we can bend to our will. And the whole of the universe, and of course ourselves, as experienced and understood by us, is the patterning of this measurable energy with its different forms of expression in various ways. I would like to go still further and say that actually the primordial reality is one only, because presented this way, it is as if it were a duality, transcendent energy and measurable energy. But I have to talk that way purely for convenience, because I don't know of any better way of putting it in speech, in verbal forms. And it is convenient for our purposes to try to understand this great mystery, to approach it that way. Now, the question immediately arises, why does one postulate a transcendent energy? If one can't deal with it, one doesn't know it, and so forth. For the very simple reason that there have been through the ages those human beings who, through discipline, through perhaps sometimes natural gift, were able to allow the sense functions to be pacified, the whole process of discursive verbal chatter completely to stop, yet be wholly awake in a mode of consciousness, in a mode of awareness which was utterly different in kind, in nature, from the mode of consciousness which we ordinarily have. Now, in this mode of consciousness, they experienced that which the mystics and the great teachers, the perfected holy ones, have talked of in terms which convey nothing to the ordinary logical intellect. They talk of it as the abyss, the unfathomable dark, the supernal light, the absolute all, the incomprehensible, unthinkable, and so on and so on. Now the question arises, is this an illusion or is it a reality? And I suggest that the very simple proof that it is a reality is just this, that whosoever has purified himself and can enter this state and emerge out of it, he is a person who is utterly transformed because of that experience. That is why I say this transcendent energy deals unto me. I can't deal with it or deal unto it. It has an absolute influence on me, utterly transforms my whole mode of awareness here and now in the world of affairs. You see, there is definite, if I may use the word in this context, material evidence, therefore, that here is an energy which defies any attempt by intellect to present it in logical terms. Here is an energy which brings about a complete transformation of me, the individual. Therefore, there is a reality to it. It is not something that just comes once and then it is gone like a will-o'-the-wisp. It is something which, if there is the discipline, and if by grace, I like to use the word grace in this context, one has entered that kind of state and really known it and can enter it time and again, then obviously it is a thing of experience for you, for me. And if it affects that transformation of one's individual being, one cannot deny its reality. So that energy is a reality. That state of consciousness is a reality. It is what some teachers in modern times talk of as pure awareness, which the Buddha designated as vijnanam anidassanam anantam, the consciousness which is without characteristics, invisible, endless, infinite, sabbato, everywhere. And the texts in one case use the word pabham, in the other case use the word pahang, meaning accessible or shining. In the Upanishads, you find the same sort of thing presented with some considerable definition of what it is not, from which one can sense what it actually is. And they simply use the words Atma or Brahman to indicate this. It is not exactly to be equated with Nirvana, remember. That is a different matter. But there is this state of awareness into which you, the human being, can enter. Now, what happens when a person, being in that state, he may be in that state for a few moments, or hours, or even days. The Buddha talks, and holy ones of the Upanishadic and Rigvedic teachings have also said the same thing. You can be in that state for so many days, up to 7 days, without stop. That is an extraordinary thing when you come to think of it. Just to be like that, in that state for 7 days, without moving, without eating, without drinking, without any of the natural functions which the body goes through, and so forth. Now, whether it be 7 seconds or whether it be 7 days, what happens as you come back to the ordinary state of consciousness in the world of affairs. This is the important point. As one comes back from a state of unitary awareness, in which there is no differentiation, in which there are no separate particulars, in which, above all, one's own isolative self-consciousness is not intrusive, and therefore you are not aware in terms of I, the separate seeing subject, is looking at you, the separate observed object. When you come back from that state, the first thing that happens is the differentiation between self and not self again. The isolative self-consciousness begins to get uppermost again. It must, of necessity. This is the case. All right. When that first distinction between self and not self has come into being, and as the process of differentiation goes on and becomes more and more complex, the impress of that transcendent state and of the energy involved in that transcendent state takes on many different shapes. These shapes are the shapes which are forms of energy which have emanated out of that primordial, differenceless state of energy. And it is seen by the Holy One that these different forms of energy are universally operative, not only through the universe, but particularly through mankind. And each of these different fundamental forms of expression is represented as the great gods. Deus, Father Heaven, Deus Pitar, Pitar is Father, Deus Pitar, Father Heaven, in the Rig Veda, is Deus Pater in Greek. And you get the word Deus, the Latin Deus, which we all use, God, which is the Deus Pitar becomes Jupiter, and so forth. You see? That is just one example. We've got the great god Varuna of the Rig Veda. We have Uranus of the Greeks. And both words are derived from the same root, var or vri, meaning to measure. The syllable is vri, meaning to measure. And both are presented as the measurers who measured out the great spaces and laid out the foundations of the universe, and so forth. You see? We get Agni, the great lord of fire. We have the Latin word ignis, meaning fire, derived from Agni. And so on and so on. If you take any of the gods of the pantheons, I think you are all better acquainted with the Greek pantheon, the names of the Greek pantheon. You have Zeus, which is Deus. Zeus. You have Athene, you have Apollo, you have Hermes, you have Ares, god of war, and you have all these, Aphrodite and the whole host of them. And you have their correspondences in the Rig Veda, you have them in the Celtic and Teutonic mythologies, and so forth. Now, they all are called immortal gods because, representing as they do traits in human nature, which are common to all mankind, as long as there is a mankind upon the earth, those gods will live. Because they are carried in our memory, and not merely in our memory, but they represent the actual functioning of human nature in its various aspects. There is the aspect of me which is the ruler, the dominator, the warrior, the fighter, the lover, the everything. Isn't that so? Well now, these continue to manifest themselves through human beings through the ages. These are the gods. So one will say, oh, then they are fictitious beings. To call them beings is the mistake. These are names given to real energies which function through all mankind. As long as you and I live on the globe, these energies are operative. The names are convenient ways of distinguishing what the energies are. Now, it's the same in connection with the archangelic and the angelic hosts, as well as the archdemonic and the demonic hosts. This was merely a way, very simply a way, and a very sensible and efficient a way of indicating that there are the constructive and the destructive forces. If you want to look at the universal process in terms of building up or breaking down. If you like to look at it biologically, in biological terms that is, there are the anabolic and the catabolic forces. And they are all necessary in order that the world process may go on. So that it is in this way that the whole world of gods and archangels and angels and the demons and all the rest of it comes into being. Now, if we really understand this, that this so-called spiritual world, which is presented as a picture, is my picturization of an actual reality. It's my picturization of an actual reality. If we realize that, then we come to the most important point involved here. If we study the scriptural statements about the gods and goddesses and all the rest of it, we are studying what happens in our own minds and hearts throughout our life. It is we who function in this way. Is that quite clear? So that reading the scriptures which have presented all this intelligently, we see how we can live the religious life in the real sense. Now, there is one great advantage in this kind of study. What has come down to us in the so-called religious mythologies of the world is a pure, undiluted wisdom. They make no mistakes. In our ignorance plus our conceit, we have deprecated the myths, and as some have said, the mythological twaddle of primitive peoples. They were not primitive peoples. They were people who appreciated, treasured, and handed down a priceless heritage. Something which was realized truth by the holy ones of the ages. There are reasons for such deprecation in modern times. We are brought up in our own morality and so forth. We have our own very intellectualist, analytical, scientific education and so forth. And therefore, when we read in the mythologies of the past that, oh, Take, for example, Ares and Aphrodite have an affair, and lo and behold, we say, oh, how utterly immoral. At least we used to say so in Victorian times. Nowadays, not that we are more advanced, but we are rather more lax. We do not condemn Ares and Aphrodite. Don't let us kid ourselves, if I may use a slang term, that we are more advanced. We are not. We are more lax today. All these things have a profound meaning in terms of our own psychological life. There is another thing to remember. The perfected holy ones not only understood psychology in our ordinary modern sense of the word, the psychology of the ordinary human being as he is, in the ill state, confused, miserable, a sinner, they also knew the psychology of the perfected Holy One. Which one of us knows through living experience what actually is the state of the psyche when there is utter purification and holiness, when there is enlightenment? Does any one of us know that? Does any scholar in the world, the great scientific psychologist, does he know anything about it at all through personal realization? He will say, oh, but we are trained in objective scientific methods, and therefore we know how to be objective and examine the reality of the thing as it is. I challenge it completely and utterly. There are things which you can see outside yourself with reasonably high objectivity. But the things of the psyche and the spirit are seen not as external objects of sight, but as internal realizations by yourself becoming that which you are observing. Which is quite a different thing. You have to be the perfected Holy One in order to know what the psyche, the mind, the thought, the very body of the perfected Holy One is like. Otherwise, we talk out of our conceit and our ignorance, out of our pathetic and folly, which has tragic consequences. So now, this psychology is also known to them, and it is also embodied in the mythologies of the world. So you see, these are, I'm putting it this way, please do remember, I take all the blame on myself for any mistakes that may be made in this. I have seen this for myself. I have not heard of it from anybody or read of it anywhere at all. What I have read is the mythologies of the world. And I never really sort of fathomed their significance until quite recently, the last 2 years, 3 years maybe. Now, bearing this in mind, we can enter into the background, the extraordinarily subtle, complex, rich, and vast background of the Buddha and his teachings. Now, you may remember that last time I said we should understand the gods as representing the various states, the hymns of the Rig Veda as an attempt to convey the different states of mind and consciousness which one goes through in the course of that discipline which brings one to perfect religious fulfillment. That is the way to approach and to understand the hymns of the Rig Veda. And in fact, to understand any of the scriptural writings. Because all scripture is concerned with you and with me, and what happens to you and me in the whole course of our religious unfoldment. That is what the scriptures are concerned with. So now, in connection with the Vedas as such, the Rig Veda particularly, the Vedas are essentially the expressions of the transformations of mind and consciousness experienced in the living process of the fruition of holiness, starting with the first metanoia, the turning in the deep seat of consciousness, the turning away from worldliness towards the spiritual, the metanoia, which is represented, this first turning away is represented in terms of the lovely dawn vision of holy living embodied in the goddess Ushas. The goddess Ushas of the Rig Veda is Eos of the Greeks, Aurora, we call her sometimes. Onward through the upholding of righteousness, of pure morality, of transcendent virtue, represented by Varuna. The triumph of spiritual victory, represented by Indra. The utter purification of the soul by the Lord of Fire, Agni. The inspirational flight of the alone to the alone in supreme communion, represented by Soma. Soma is the god of inspiration. It has nothing to do, in reality, with all the rather misleading talk about Soma being some plant which has magical effects and so forth. There are plants from which they extract a juice, and in the ordinary ritualistic ceremonial process they drink of it. It has a certain amount of intoxicating effect, and you feel rather inspired, just as a peg of whiskey can inspire certain people. And that is all there is to it. It has nothing to do with the real Soma. And I'll show you chapter and verse in the Rig Veda which gives this away completely. And finally, the blazing forth of the light of realized transcendence, which is represented by Aditya, which is the sun in the cloud, in the unclouded heavens. Aditya means born of Diti, and Diti is the goddess who represents the infinite. I forget the exact word, I think it's Apatsayon of Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher. I shouldn't forget these words. So now, that is what the gods represent. Now, let us start with the god Varuna, because some of the earliest hymns of the Rig Veda are to the god Varuna, and Varuna represents righteousness. As presented in the Rig Veda, he is clearly a god who represents the moral government of the entire universe. And Varuna is the word which corresponds to the Greek Uranos, meaning to measure. But before I deal with Varuna himself directly, there's one other thing I'd like to mention. The celestial family is presented by the Rig Veda after the pattern of the human family. Father Sky and Mother Earth are the parents of all the gods, the devas, and also of men. In the Homeric poems, you find the same thing. Mother Earth is the wife of starry heaven, and she gives birth to everything. The divine race is composed of various groups, such as the Adityas, Vasus, Rudras, the semi-divine Angirasas, and lower deities such as the Ribhus, Apsarasas, and Gandharvas. Buddhism uses the term Angiras as well as the Gandharvas, very definitely. Collectively, they are called Vishvadeva, or the All Gods. It's a very interesting thing. The hymns to the All Gods are some of the loveliest of the hymns of the Rig Veda. Every time I come across one of those hymns, it really thrills me. The gods have, like men, their specific functions. Agni and Brihaspati are priests. Indra and the Maruts, warriors. Tvashtar and the Ribhus, artisans. While Kshetrapati, lord of the field, Urvara, she of the ploughland, and Sita, she of the furrow, are agricultural deities. But they are not exclusive functionaries. Parjanya, Varuna, Indra, Deyaus, Rudra, and the Maruts are all rainmakers. Now, don't let us get misled that it is merely the stuff that, the liquid that falls on our heads when we least want it to fall on our heads. They are not rainmakers in that sense. This is the symbolic term for that which fertilizes, the waters of life which are necessary. The waters which stand for the opening up of one's intellectual perceptions to. You see? This is the rain that falls. I often wonder whether the flood spoken of in the Bible hasn't some relationship to this, that it completely overwhelmed mankind, this flood of inspiration, and only the Holy One who could withstand it was the one who was saved, together with those whom he collected in his ark. See, it's a very interesting line to investigate. The flood which was sent. And why Noah, you see in the Bible, and Noah walked with God. And he's the only one who walked with God in that day and age. When the Lord God said that he was sick to death of mankind because all the ways of his heart and mind were evil. And so this great flood of inspiration, which absolutely overwhelmed all the philosophical chatterers of the day, the intellectual speculators and whatnot. But this Holy One understood and was saved. Maybe that is a line which one could investigate. All these gods are rainmakers. Indra and Trita Aptya make lightning. Rudra and the Maruts, Varuna, Soma, the Ashwins, Vata and the waters are all physicians. Agni, Indra and the gods of light are demon slayers. And Brihaspati, the Maruts and the Angirasas are divine minstrels. See the sort of way in which it is all presented. Now, I only want to make one point in this connection. As we are considering the way we are brought up and educated and so forth, are almost wholly analytical in our approach to everything. We are aware of our whole life and of the world in terms of separate bits and bobs. We fail to be really conscious, really awake to all the relationships between all human beings and human beings and things and situations and whatnot. We are unawake to that relationship which makes for the wholeness. The great overriding marvelous unitary reality. If we were awake to this unitariness of the totality, then our lives would be lives marked by nothing else but love and wisdom and goodness and beauty and so on. Because we are unawake to this and are only awake in terms of separateness, that there is conflict, that there is confusion and misery. But I believe that the Rig Vedic teachers presented it this way in order to emphasize the wholeness, the holiness of the totality, whatsoever the impression upon our limited analytical discriminative consciousness might be, of non-harmony. The impression on us is that the world is disharmonious and terrible and so forth. In a sense, yes. But if you and I were conscious, as eternal God is conscious, as the totality is conscious, would we call it a disharmony? Would we be troubled? There are all sorts of extraordinary conflicting tensions and processes going on within the body itself, the body which is healthy. But as long as the body is healthy, does that person say that I am in trouble or in pain? He doesn't. But there they are, conflicting forces in operation. But they are complementary to each other in the state of wholeness, in the state of health. And therefore, it seems to me that those holy ones of the old days presented this in order to teach us to become aware of the wholeness of existence. Now, to go to Varuna. Varuna, the moral governor of the universe and of man himself, is, I would say, the embodiment of what I have always called transcendental virtue. We have talked about this in some of our meetings, especially in the early part of this year. This virtue which is transcendent power in operation, which is creative, and whose expressions we describe as transcendent love or wisdom or goodness or purity, in which there is no trace of evil whatsoever. And that sort of transcendent virtue is expressed in the person who in the Upanishads is termed the Purusha. You remember I explained the meaning of this word Purusha. He in whom all evil-mindedness is completely burnt out. How then do the psychic and mental and spiritual energies function, except in terms of perfect and complete love and wisdom and beauty and so forth? And Varuna is the embodiment of this, this transcendent virtue. Now, see what is said here. I'm just going to read you a few lines out of one of the hymns in the first book of the Rig Veda. Varuna, king of hallowed might, sustaineth erect the tree's stem in the baseless region. Its rays, whose root is high above, stream downward. Deep may they sink within us and be hidden. King Varuna hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun wherein to travel. Now, of course, the ordinary scholarly presentations all talk of this in naturalistic terms, that the old people were sort of representing things which happened in the air around them. Nothing of the sort. Now let us look at it this way. Varuna, king of hallowed might, of strength, of omnipotence, which is sacred, which is pure. If it is sacred and pure, there will be no imposition upon anything in the universe. power which is transcendent in reality has no compulsiveness in it, has no imposition in it. It doesn't function in terms of repressing anything or hurting anything. It functions only in terms of releasing life and beauty and bringing everything to fruition. That is how omnipotence works. All right. Of hallowed might, sustaineth erect the tree's stem in the baseless region. Now, I should like to know which scholar has ever sensibly and truly explained that. What is this tree in the baseless region? Sustaineth erect. The brain, the nervous system, the spinal column. Remember that the scriptures are always talking about you and what happens to you. This is the tree referred to, the Ashwatha tree, the tree to which Sri Krishna refers in the Gita. The Bodhi tree is really this tree, the tree of enlightenment. This is the tree of life as well as the tree of good and evil. And note very carefully, he talks, the Holy One who wrote this poem says, sustaineth erect the tree's stem in the baseless region, its rays, whose root is high above, stream downward. This root is high above. Man, and this tree in man, is the upside down tree. If we take the word tree in its ordinary meaning of the tree which grows in the earth. Now the tree which grows in the earth has roots which are geotropic. They go down towards the center of the earth. Our root is heliotropic. The roots of a tree go towards an end point, point towards an end point, the center of the earth. They represent finitude. They represent greater concretization. Our roots point to the zenith, to the infinite. Significant, isn't it? Now, Varuna, virtue, the God who is the moral governor, sustaineth this tree erect, upright, healthy, strong, flourishing. This is what Varuna stands for. In other words, in your own being, in my own being, there is this transcendent power present. The power of, if we use theistic language, God who is the absolute good. The absolute good. The supreme morality. It is from this that we derive our categorical imperative where our moral life is concerned. This is the source of it. The source is transcendence itself. Otherwise, no human being can really have that sense of categorical imperative strong enough to make him, when the stress of the moment demands it, make him perform extraordinary things, which are the very embodiment of nobility and virtue and goodness and the highest flights to which human action can go. Self-sacrifice in the magnificent way, the fine way, the perfect way, the way which divinizes man and does not degrade him. This is Varuna. And these are just a few lines about him. Now he goes on, its rays, whose root is high above, stream downward, Deep may they sink within us and be hidden. The rays which are referred to. We don't talk of rays where a tree is concerned. He has said tree. We usually would say branches or stems or some such thing, wouldn't we? But he uses the word rays, meaning influences, energies, which stream out of, stem forth, go right into our being from the infinite transcendent realm. And he says, may they go deep into us. And these streams, these rays, are the channels, so to say, the sort of infinite number of channels through which this divine energy can pour into us, energize us, if only we will give ourselves to it and live by it. If to thyself thou be true. Now, which self is this to which you are true? Your real self is the one and only self, the one and only I am, which is transcendence itself embodied in you. Be true to that. And all the rest is all right. Not according to my definitions, my petty little criteria and standards, but in terms of truth itself, in terms of the total reality. You see how wonderfully those old people taught. You see how this was something to which only the few could truly respond. A larger number could thrill to it, perhaps. But for the rest, no. So you see why certain things remain esoteric. And the exoteric, the word, has come down, and the pious devotee and the impious man of the world reads it and says, oh, what's all this stuff about? What else can he do but say that? This is the meaning of dukkha, isn't it? That mankind is in that state. The Buddha, of course, talked, at least to the the recorded teachings which have come down to us, deal with what you've got to do. And since the whole of the teaching necessarily must be fundamentally psychological, you have in the Buddhist presentation the silas, the virtues, the moralities. Now perhaps, looking at these, this is the background out of which all these teachings come. And remember that this antedates the Buddha by at least 15, if not up to 20 or more centuries. The Rig Veda antedates him by that. You see? Then these two lines. King Varuna hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun wherein to travel. Aditya, the sun. The sun represents the full-fledged enlightened consciousness. That is what the sun represents. Aditya represents that. You find in the Upanishads, then Yajnavalkya, this is in the Mandala Brahmana Upanishad, then Yajnavalkya went up to the regent of the sun. He entered that state of fully enlightened consciousness, shining, bright. See? Now, King Varuna makes a spacious pathway. We know the phrase, straight and narrow is the path, as it comes in the New Testament. But King Varuna makes a spacious pathway. We think of it as, oh, so difficult, fraught with conflict, trouble, effort, and all the rest of it. But The perfected Holy One says, oh, it's so easy. You just move as you please, almost, and the enlightenment is there for you. Makes a spacious pathway. Out of the infinite comes enlightenment. Not through the petty little finite procedures and methods we adopt in order to gain a selfish end of enlightenment or perfection. Because that sort of end, at its root, has the pleasure principle, the pleasure drive. I want to be comfortable and happy and fulfilled. Or it is the egotistic drive. I am going to be the supreme teacher, the Holy One, and all the rest of that. See? These are the... It's a spacious pathway which he makes. But look at the significance. It's the Lord of Virtue who makes the pathway for enlightenment. The absolute basis. Now, we have talked about this time and again. The indispensable basis for the living of the holy life is very simply virtue. And way back in the Rig Veda, you have it emphasized.